Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Elections have consequences, and the 2016 election will have plenty of them. Our next guest has been spending time looking at potential legal and judicial implications of the 2016 election. Doug Bondo is senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be on.
So obviously, for many reasons, the 2016 election is going to be very important. You've been focusing on sort of the legal and judicial impacts that could come about because of 2016. What have you been focusing on particularly?
Well, this is a major election for the Supreme Court. There's not only the Scalia vacancy because the Republicans refused to confirm, you know, the President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, so that one remains vacant. But also, we have three justices who are at 78 or older, and 78 has been the average retirement age. So we're looking at the potential of Justice Ginsburg, of Justice Breyer, and Justice Kennedy. All are at the age where one could imagine them retiring. You could see the next president have four Supreme Court nominations. Well, that, you know, that's almost half the court. That would be extraordinary.
And some people listening who don't follow the court very closely might say, well, so what? Big deal. What happens when you have so many new faces on the court?
Well, it would be transformational in terms of the philosophy of the court. Now, the reality is, while the court talks about the Constitution, and in theory, these justices are not, you know, guided by political views, you know, the reality is we have folks there who range from left to right in terms of how they view the Constitution, the kind of rulings they would engage in. And if you include Scalia, we're talking about there's a major conservative, Scalia, someone who's kind of center-right, Kennedy, and two folks on the left, Ginsburg and Breyer. I mean, you have an opportunity then to shift the court pretty dramatically. Right now, it's kind of a 5-4, you know, sort of thing. Kennedy shifts back and forth. Well, if you shift that by a couple of votes, suddenly you have a solid majority one way or the other. It's a big different change in the court.
Well, the two candidates who are battling it out to win the presidential race, the ones who will make this appointment, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do we have much of a sense of what types of justices they would appoint?
Well, we don't know for certain, obviously. I mean, Hillary Clinton has supported Merrick Garland, the nominee of President Obama. In fact, he worked in the Clinton Justice Department. She might resubmit him, I suppose, if she was elected president. There's no reason to think that she's uncomfortable with the kind of justices that both her husband and Barack Obama nominated. My guess is that she would be fairly liberal in the people that she chose. You know, the people chosen by President Obama, Elaine Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, both are on the left of the court. They've moved the court in a more left-wing direction. I would assume that Hillary Clinton would do the same. You know, Donald Trump, it's a little harder to know. Now, Trump has actually given a list of 11 potential nominees. Now, these are people who are very well respected on the right. If, in fact, he followed through on that list, we'd be talking about the kind of appointments you would have expected out of a Bush or a Reagan that could move the appointment then, the court, to the right. We just don't know if he'd follow through. I think there are reasons to believe he would, but look, we don't know what Donald Trump would do. This is a unique candidate, a unique candidacy, a unique moment. Boy, making predictions there is pretty hard.
We are chatting with Doug Bondo, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Once we see new faces on the court, what types of impact could they have on the way our government and our judicial process moves forward?
Well, there are a couple of things. It's not just the Supreme Court. There's also the appellate courts. Supreme Court hears about 80, you know, cases a year. There are 13 districts, or 13 circuits, that is, of appellate. They have about 7,000 cases total a year. And in most instances, then, those opinions are final. I mean, reality. Now, you know, each circuit is technically final only for that particular circuit, but these are large chunks of America. So if what you find is at the top, these 80 cases, you know, a lot of those are fairly administrative or legal kinds of technical stuff, sometimes unanimous, but you're almost certainly going to get 4, 5, 6 big ones. I mean, it'll be abortion, it'll be health care, it'll be religious liberty, it'll be, you know, that sort of a thing. Those could be transformational in those areas of the law. And once the Supreme Court has set that ruling, then it trickles down to the circuits. Right now, 9 out of the 13 circuits are dominated by Democratic nominees. You know, at the end of another 4 years of a Democratic president, almost certainly all of those would be dominated by Democratic, you know, nominees. Now, if you have a Republican, you'd see a reversal of that, and some number of those would shift back and it'd be a much more balanced circuit. So I think that gives the sense. It's not just Supreme Court where those big cases get decided. It's the next level down where there's so many that almost all decisions that go there are final. It matters who's on those courts as well.
And if you have different philosophies approaching these cases, how does that lead to different types of rulings? Maybe pick a favorite subject area and tell us how they would rule differently.
Well, for example, the issue of, say, religious liberty. I mean, to what extent do you believe that people have a right to practice their religion, even if it means at some level? For example, I mean, the gay marriage issues come up. You know, I think the famous case, it's the baker who says, I don't want to bake a cake for a same-sex marriage because I don't believe in the ceremony. I mean, what's important here, you know, this is not an issue of discrimination against somebody because they're gay. It's simply saying, I don't want to participate in something. To me, that's a fairly easy decision in terms of religious liberty. Whatever you think about same-sex marriage, the point is somebody shouldn't be groomed into having to support that. But that's one where you're very likely to find on the right and the left different opinions. What you find is people on the left tend to be more focused on what they perceive as discrimination. They don't like it, and they may not even grant that to somebody because of religious reasons. People on the right are much more likely to be focused on the importance of religious liberty, the importance of kind of strengthening the First Amendment. That's the kind of decision one could see decided differently. Healthcare under Obama, it's been decided, but there could be other cases that come up. You know, is there a constitutional justification for this legislation? Conservatives generally said no. Liberals said yes. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin with the Chief Justice, you know, the Republican nominee kind of shifting, said yes. Again, these are decisions. If these decisions came up with a very different membership, it could go the different way.
You are affiliated with the Libertarian Cato Institute, and we know that one thing that libertarians have stressed about the courts is, on the right side of the spectrum, the difference between those who want an engaged judiciary and ones who want to defer to the elected branches of government. Do we have a sense whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump have a preference one way or the other?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton clearly wants a more active kind of view. I mean, she certainly fits with traditional liberalism, which I think essentially courts are, judges are allies of those who want expansive government. That, you know, in the criminal law area, some of them may, you know, put some barriers, but for the most part, the view is government should be allowed to expand. So the irony is that in areas like, say, Fourth Amendment search and seizure, you know, the more liberal justice might say, you know, here we don't want the police doing that, so they'd step in. In other areas like healthcare, they'd say, oh, the Congress has approved it, we shouldn't step in. You know, the challenge on the right is you do have a breakdown between people who talk about judicial restraint and people who try to take a different perspective. And I think that it's a very important difference. You know, the judicial restraint crowd focuses simply on whether the legislature, you know, is involved or not in allowing the legislature to do what it wants. I don't believe that's what the Constitution says. My view is restraint is simply a tool. It's a means to the end, which is vindicating the Constitution. So in some places, I think the Constitution is pretty clear. I mean, you know, the court shouldn't step in. It's a legislative decision. You allow it to go forward. But there are other places. Fourth Amendment is a very good one of protecting us from unlawful searches. The only way you protect that constitutional amendment, and it's part of the Bill of Rights, is for a court to step in at some point and say, no, you can't do that. The Constitution requires that we do something different. And there, I think, who knows what Donald Trump thinks? I mean, my sense is that he has no judicial philosophy. I think that he recognizes this is an important issue for conservatives and probably would choose justices that generally fit on the right.
One person who will be watching very closely as that moves forward is Doug Bondo, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.